We're going to cover parts of chapter 4 and a little bit of chapter 5 today, but I would like to just kind of give you a picture to think about with me. I just want you to imagine that you're standing in front of a wall, and on this wall are a lot of different doors that you could walk through. Multiple doors, then you can just pick one, open it, and walk through it. But above all of those doors, there's this giant sign that says, "The Wall of a Meaningful Life." And so you step up, you see all these doors, you see the sign, and each door has a sign on it promising something a little different. So one door might say knowledge on it. One door might say pleasure. One door says entertainment. One door says success. Another one, relationships. Another one, wealth. And then there's one door at the very end, the very last option, that says wisdom on it. So you start to try the different doors. You start to open one and go in, open the next one and go in, open the next one and go in. And after a while, after trying multiple doors, you start to realize that a lot of the doors take you to the same room, which surprises you because you thought they would all go to a different place. They don't all take you in the same way to that room, or maybe necessarily at the same time, but they all take you eventually to an empty room. And you have exhausted all the options. You went through the door of knowledge. You went through the door of entertainment. You went through the door of success. You went through the door of wealth, and they all led you to the same empty room. But there's one door you haven't tried, and that's the door of wisdom. And so you go over to that door at the very end, you walk through it, and it takes you to a different room than all the rest of the doors, the room that they took you to. You go into that room, and you can't exactly put it into words, and you can't exactly put your finger on it, but there's something filling about that room. There's something satisfying about that room, yet there's also something really weighty about being in that room. This is a picture of the truth that is set before us in the book of Ecclesiastes. This is what Solomon, calling himself the preacher in this book, has been bringing us to over and over and over, that we are all, no matter age or background or stage in life or anything, all of us are in some form or fashion chasing meaning in life. And it looks like from our perspective, from our perception of the world, there are many options to pick from. But there's actually only two. There's only two ways of life to actually choose from. The Bible's language would be the way of the fool or the way of the wise. The way of the fool or the way of the wise. Now, those terms might not mean a lot to you right now if you're not familiar with those terms from the Bible, and that's okay. But we're going to see contrasting pictures of those two ways as we work through parts of Ecclesiastes 4 and 5 here. The way of the fool and the way of the wise. And we're going to see those two big categories, but zoomed in on specific examples. And in these chapters, Ecclesiastes is a challenging book. There's parts of the book that's a little strange. There's parts of the book that's very clear. But no matter what part of the book you're in, you can always say he's not giving us some kind of flat 2D picture. It's very much a pop-up book that jumps off the page to tell us, and what he's trying to tell us over and over and over, and especially here in chapters 4 and 5, is be careful not to live for what doesn't matter. Be careful not to live for what's meaningless. Live for what's eternal. Live for what lasts. You can't find meaning from something that doesn't last. And he's going to show us this in chapters 4 and 5. And we're just going to see with those two paths, the reason all those doors led to the same room and this door of wisdom leads to a different room is it gives us two options of how we're to live our lives, the things we're going to build on and anchor on. And here's how I would like to phrase these two options for two parts here. One, we're going to see that you can either be a getter or a giver. I don't know if getter is a word, but we're just going with that. You can either be a getter or a giver. The other option, the other contrast is you can either be divided or you can be devoted. Getter or giver, divided or devoted. And we'll see how those things connect to each other. But let's start with the first one. You can be a getter or you can be a giver. As we've seen week after week, this book, if you're just joining us, this book, the book of Ecclesiastes, is essentially Solomon's autobiography. He is telling his story of how he chased after meaning. And he says, I opened all those doors And let me tell you how I opened all those doors, and let me tell you what that was like, and let me tell you how not satisfying that was as I opened all those doors. And along the way, as he's recounting his own story, he is also looking around at the world and cluing us in on observations of how he's seen the world as he's gone through this journey. And he keeps pointing out what he sees to try to help himself and to try to help us make sense of it all. And here's one of those observations in verse 4. I read this just a minute ago, but let's kind of slowly walk through this little part here. Chapter 4, verse 4. Then I saw, so he's looking around at the world and he notices and observes this. Then I saw that all toil and all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Last week, we talked a little bit about work, and this connects to that in some ways, but it's kind of a different angle, not just what the work is that we do, but he's zooming in here on why we do the work that we do. Why we have different professions, why you might go to school, why you might, how you approach retirement or whatever season of life you're in. He's saying, I've looked around and here's what I've noticed. All toil, all work, all skill, it's done because a man envies his neighbor. That's the motivation. He says that as I looked around at life in this world, the main motivation I saw in people everywhere is jealousy. And you might think, all work, all people? Solomon's speaking in hyperbole here, I'm sure. Well, maybe in some ways, but think about this with me. This doesn't just apply to work. It applies to all of life. A lot of the things that you and I do are driven by a desire to outshine other people, or at least to make sure they don't outshine us. So you feel this tension, and this wouldn't be true for everyone you know, and this is maybe not true for big groups of people, but there might be one or two people in your life that when they succeed, it hits you a little different than when somebody else succeeds. Other people you can be like, man, I'm so happy for you, but there's that one particular person that succeeds in that one particular way that you're like, oh, I kind of wanted that, or I at least didn't want them to have that. And we feel these kinds of things. I mean, the cliche way of saying this in our culture is we're all keeping up with the Joneses. And it's a cliche saying, but there's a truth that we're all competing with our neighbors in different ways. We're all chasing a certain status. And like I said, it may not be some giant group, but there's someone you want to get ahead of and stay ahead of. There's someone you want to make sure we're doing better in life than they are. I mean, you just ask Kentucky fans how they feel about that. They want them, they all this season wanted to make, and I don't know a lot of Kentucky fans. I'm kind of neutral in the whole deal, so I'm just kind of observing on the outside looking in. But you ask Kentucky fans how they felt about John Calipari being in Arkansas, and then you talk to them today. Maybe they're kind of quiet today. I don't know. Maybe. But the preacher would look at this kind of rat race that we're all on, and he would say, it's vanity, it's chasing after wind. You're not going to find meaning by just trying to get ahead of the next person. You're not going to find satisfaction by just trying to outshine your neighbor. It's an empty room that you're walking into. But he also says there's an opposite approach to life. There's the overly ambitious person, but then there's the person at the other extreme. Look at verse 5. The fool folds his hands. So there's that word, the fool. We're talking about those two ways, the wise and the fool. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. So keep looking for that word fool as we go. But this person does not work. It says he folds his hands. This is similar wording that you'll see in a book like Proverbs that comes right before Ecclesiastes, where it talks about this character called the sluggard. And he says his motto is a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. And that's the kind of person he's talking about here. And he gives us this kind of gross picture. Really, he says, the fool folds his hand and eats his own flesh. The picture is that laziness is a self-destructive thing. That you can swing away from overambition to laziness, but that's just as harmful to you as the other. It's vanity. It's a chasing after wind. Laziness is empty. It's self-destructive. Now, going and going and chasing and chasing and climbing and climbing just to make sure you're better than someone else is an empty way to live. And ignoring the responsibilities that God has given you around you is also an empty way to live. But how could both of those things be empty ways to live? They're so different. How could that be? Well, both are short-sighted and both are meaningless because both of those lifestyles have the same person at the center, yourself. You could see a person who is one of the most hardworking people you've ever met in your life, and you could see a person who stays away from work as far as they possibly can, and they're both thinking about the same person, themselves. And that's why he says, this is an empty way, that this is an empty room you're going to walk into. They're both about getting, actually. One, getting more than other people, getting ahead of other people. The lazy person, getting without any concern for other people. I just need what I need. Who cares about other people? But they both have the same person in the middle, and that's why they're empty, because they're self-centered. Maybe some of you, not everyone's going to be in the same place with this morning, but maybe some of you are tempted to envy what other people have, and so you wear yourself out trying to get it. Or maybe you think you're above all that, you're kind of beyond all that, that's not really your thing, so you actually kind of avoid work and avoid ambition altogether in certain areas of life. Either way, the preacher here has wisdom for us. The way of wisdom, the right middle ground, is verse 6. Here's what he says in verse 6. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after wind. Think about that word quietness for a second. Better is a handful of quietness. Quietness is rest. Quietness is your mind is at peace. Your soul is calm. There's a contentment in your life. Better is a handful of quietness. This is a person who works hard at the calling God has given him or her and is content with just having the basic things in life and trust the Lord to provide exactly what they need. So it's not the lazy person who doesn't go after, who doesn't get out, who doesn't do things, who doesn't contribute to others and to society. It's not the overambitious person who will run over other people to get where they want to go. It's a person, I don't even want to say in the middle, they're kind of in a different category altogether, who realizes the benefit and good gift of God that work is, but also realizes they don't live in a world by themselves. There's other people too. And they're not someone to be trampled on or ignored. They're someone to be served and trusting the Lord in the midst of all that. Well, that sounds really great, right? That sounds great. Like if I could just learn to just trust the Lord, go to work or whatever your daily routine is, go to school, and then just trying to trust him to provide and think about other people, the world would be amazing if we all did that. But how? How do we get to that place? We're gonna see that here in just a minute. But first, I want to point out another contrast that helps us see this a little more clearly. Look at what he describes in verse 7. As we read verses 7 and 8, think if you, not if you know someone personally like this, if you've heard of someone somewhere in some kind of story or movie that is like this. I think there would be someone that might come to your mind. Verse 7. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. And here's his observation. One person who has no other, either son or a brother, yet there is no end to all his toil. And his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. So he describes a person who can never get enough money to be satisfied, who just works and works and goes and strives to the point that they have completely alienated themselves from other people and all they care about is getting more and working more. First person that came to my mind was Ebenezer Scrooge. Was the first person I thought of. Because in whatever version of A Christmas Carol that you enjoy, this is who he is. He's working and working and working and money and money and money, and he's completely pushed other people away in his life. Now, that's a character in a story, but these are real things that we're talking about. These are real people. And maybe you think of someone else, but there's a sense in which we all have seeds of this in our hearts, all have leanings towards these different things. Thinking about a person who has no family, no friends really, but pours themselves into work and money, but yet never reaches the point of being satisfied, just thinking, what else can I get? What else can I get? And the way he describes that kind of lifestyle is, this also is vanity and an unhappy business. A life without real relationships and a life without real meaning is a life of isolation, is a life of emptiness. It's an unhappy business. And just like with the way of the fool that we just saw earlier in chapter 4, and then he gave us a better way in verse 6, he gives us another better way than living like that. Here's the better way, verse 9. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow, but woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm, but how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. So he advocates for the opposite kind of life from a self-centered, isolated life. What he describes is a life of community with other people, a life where you need others and they need you, a life where others know you and you know them. He's talking about working with others, not just getting from other people or getting above people or past people, but giving to other people. Two are better than one. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. If one falls, they have one to lift them up. I think if I just summarize this little section of chapter 4, I would say that a key ingredient, I'm not saying the only ingredient, but a key ingredient to a meaningful life is learning to value people more than stuff. Now, there's like deep biblical roots in that. You don't have to go to church to hear that kind of statement, but I want you to know there's a reason Ecclesiastes is saying it. And we'll see that here in just a second. But the key ingredient to a meaningful life is learning to value people more than stuff, is learning to value relationships more than possessions. One author said that for the preacher, the value of life is not what you earn, but whom you relate to. Just hearing that statement just now, where does that cause a rub in your life? I'm not saying that all of us are completely 100% running against that, but there's for all of us ways that we are running away from that, running against that a little bit. So where does that statement cause a rub for you? That a meaningful life, part of a meaningful life, is learning to value people more than stuff, learning to value relationships more than possessions, that it's not so much about what you earn as it is about whom you relate to. Where do you feel the tension of that in your life right now? Maybe it's something with work, in the way you're approaching your work. Maybe it's something with school and the way you're approaching grades or scholarships or college. Maybe it's even the way you think about retirement and what your goals are or what you're trying to accomplish in retirement. But what would it look like for you in whatever season you're in to value people more than stuff? To have a greater focus on who you relate to than what you earn or what you have? We do not exist solely for our own benefit. So living to just get and living as a getter, I promise you, Solomon promises you, it's a dead end. You can walk through that door, it's an empty room at the end of it. But living to give, living to share, living to contribute, that's part of the steps you take on the road to finding true meaning in life. That's actually part of the fruit of finding true meaning in life. And the source of all that, the foundation of all that, we start to see it a little bit in chapter 5. And so that's the next part, that we can be a getter or a giver, but underneath that, you can be divided or you can be devoted. You can be divided or you can be devoted. And I'll show you where that comes from in chapter 5. As we come to chapter 5, we're coming to a section that many people view that this is the center of the book. the literary center of the book, the theological center of the book, and certainly, whatever you think about that, maybe you don't have thoughts about that, but it's definitely a truth that is at the red-hot core of the book of Ecclesiastes. And it's important to understand these words here in chapter 5 because he gives us some words of caution. And they're going to sound maybe a little different to your ear, but let's just take them in slowly and see what the Lord has for us. Verse 1, just the first part of verse 1. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Guard your steps. Think about that phrase with me. I don't think he's suggesting that there is one proper way to physically walk into church. I don't think it's about a physical thing. Like when you step into church, make sure you kind of tiptoe your way in. Walk very carefully. I don't think that's what he's after. Because I think the Bible often describes the way you and I live, just our general lifestyle, with this image of walking, with your steps. You see this in Proverbs. You see this in the Psalms. You see this all over the place, that your walk, where your steps go, is your lifestyle, your behavior, your actions, your desires, your thoughts. So when he says, guard your steps when you go to the house of God, I think he's saying, pay attention to how your life lines up with how you worship. That's heavy. We should feel the weight of that. Pay attention to how you live and how that lines up with how you claim to worship the Lord. Just as a practical encouragement, there's a few more things I want to learn here, but just as a practical encouragement and question for us to think about is, how do you approach and think about Sundays? I have to think about this too. We all need to think about this. How do we approach and think about Sundays? What is your preparation for a Sunday morning look like? What's your mindset coming in here? I'm not saying about like your week or good or bad mood or whatever. We all are in different places on those things all the time. But just general big category, when you are thinking about Sunday morning getting here and you are thinking, I'm going to go to a life class, I'm going to go to the worship service, I'm going to go just the worship service, whatever it may be, what is your attitude coming in here? Do you stay up really late on Saturday night and you're just exhausted when you come in here on Sunday morning? Do you think to, like, what am I coming here to do on Sunday mornings? What are we coming here? What is this about? What's this for? What's the purpose of this? We do it week after week after week. Why? But just to center ourselves on this truth and just practically, we're going to bed at a decent hour Saturday night. We get up Sunday morning, maybe even have a short time on our own or with your family, with a friend, just praying for the morning, quieting your heart before the Lord, and coming ready to encourage someone. And many of you do this so well. I'm actually, if you can be a little jealous of this, I am, but many of you do this so well that I see you walking into this building immediately looking for other people, which my default is probably walking into this building and room and immediately thinking about myself and what do I need to do and all these things. But we are showing up here to pray. We are showing up here to listen to the word. So we don't stay up all night. We don't wake up late. We don't show up late and just kind of sort of halfway participate or halfway engage. But we're coming saying, Lord, I want to sit before you right now. I want to sit before your word. Teach me, use me, change me. We don't just want to show up and go through the motions. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Think carefully about your life when you go to the house of God. And then he explains this further in the next sentence, kind of gives us a picture of what this looks like. The next part of verse 1, he says, to draw near, to listen, is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. So the difference between the wise and the fools shows up again. And one of these better statements shows up again. To draw near to God to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools because they don't know that they're doing evil. So he says it's better to be wise and draw near to God to listen to him than it is to be a fool than to come to offer a sacrifice to God. In the Old Testament, in the temple, which is the house of God that he would have been talking about in his day, they were coming offering sacrifices and sacrifices for the forgiveness of their sins, which we would think that's a really good thing. If this is what God's commanded us to do in the Old Testament and that's what they did in the Old Testament, then we should probably do that. But he says showing up to listen is better than doing that. Well, he calls it the sacrifice of fools. And then he explains what that looks like a little bit in verse 2. He says, "Be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. For God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few." So how is showing up to listen better than showing up to offer a sacrifice? Well, it's the difference between showing up to think about the words you have and what you're contributing and who you are and what's going on, and the difference between thinking about showing up and thinking about God's word and who he is and what he has done. The sacrifice of fools is the person who shows up to church with a lot of religious talk and even religious action, but key point here, their heart is divided. This is why I said you can be divided or you can be devoted. That they've convinced themselves they're good with God as long as they go to church and give time or give some money, but it doesn't really matter how they treat their spouse or how they talk at work or how they act at school. But I just kind of went through the religious routine, so I'm good. And Solomon says that is the sacrifice of fools. And he says at the end of verse 1, this person doesn't even know they're doing evil. Meaning, this person is so used to playing games with God, they don't even realize it's wrong anymore. That they can fill a prayer with spiritual phrases, they can fill a Bible study with talking points, but they end up being more impressed with their own words than they are with God's words. This is not the only way it could show up, but a way to think about it show up is this story of Ananias and Sapphira in the book of Acts. In Acts chapter 5, you have this couple, Ananias and Sapphira, who bring their offering to offer it to the disciples to use for the ministries of the church. But what Ananias and Sapphira know, but what the apostles don't yet know, what Peter doesn't yet know, is Ananias and Sapphira sold some land, got money from that, and then brought part of that money to give to the church. And God strikes them both dead because of it. Now, the lesson here is not you have to go and give all your money to the church and don't keep anything for yourself. That's not why they were judged by God. They were judged by God because they gave part of their money to the church, acting as if they were giving all the proceeds to the church. They were divided. They wanted to look generous without the commitment and sacrifice of being generous. They wanted to look like they were worshiping without the sacrifice and commitment of actually really worshiping. They talked a good talk, but their true heart and life did not back it up. So when you and I use church or use God to exalt our own name or to exalt our own dreams or carry out our own plans, Solomon says it's a sacrifice of fools. It's not honoring who the Lord is. So the preacher here, he looks us in the eye and he says, watch out. Be careful. Think carefully. You need to know that approaching God can be a dangerous thing if you're approaching him thinking he could not care less what's happening in your heart. It's dangerous to come to church and lift your hands and worship the Lord while all at the same time thinking God doesn't care how you treat your spouse or your colleagues or someone in your family. He cares deeply about those things. And that's why he says, it's better to draw near to listen. That the antidote to a divided heart is actually drawing it near to listen. And I think this idea of listening is rooted in one of the most important passages from the Old Testament. It's often called the Shema. This comes up in the book of Deuteronomy where it says, the very first word is, hear, O Israel. Listen, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your might. Hear, O Israel. Listen, O Israel. It is better to draw near to listen. The connection that listening is not just hearing, not just audible words going into your ears, but listening is hearing, paying attention, and then acting with this kind of heart-level obedience in your life. That's why it's better to draw near to listen than it is to offer a sacrifice. One is with the heart, one is without. But here the unity and sincerity in those words that I read from Deuteronomy 6. The Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, not part of it, all of it, and with all your soul, and with all your might. God is not looking for people who will give him their strength while their love and desires are directed elsewhere. Real faith in the Lord is not compartmentalized. Real faith in the Lord is not separated into, okay, this area of my life is kind of the God area, the Bible area, the Christian area, and then all these other areas, I kind of do what I want. And that's not faith in Christ. He would say, guard your steps when you go to the house of God. That you could have great passion and energy and fervor and emotion, but what if you don't have serious thinking about the Bible and obedience to what it says? Or what if you were a deep thinker about the Bible and about theology and about the truths of Christianity, but you don't ever really obey it and you have little passion, your heart is dull and cold? Or what if you obey, you go through the motions, you serve, you show up, you help, you do different things, but there's no passion in your heart and no deep thinking about what the Word of God says and who He is? God would say, I want you to love me with all your heart and all your soul and all your might. But notice, just to make a point really clear here, when he says guard your steps when you go to the house of God, and he points out how the way of the wise looks at the house of God, the way of the fool looks at the house of God, he never says the problem is with the house of God. Translated for us today, he never says the problem is with church. The problem lies in our hearts. The problem lies in our souls. It's not, well, we just need to get rid of church because there's hypocrites and there's people that say one thing and do another. Yes, that's true. And that's been true every generation God's people have existed in this world. But the solution is not to throw away church. The solution is to check our own hearts. Because when we are fine with playing religious games, it shows us we have lost sight of who we really are and who God really is. That's why he says in Ephesians 5, verse 2, don't be rash with your mouth. Don't let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. For God is in heaven and you are on earth. God is in heaven and you are on earth. Translation, we have no business on our own being in the presence of God. But here we are. By his grace, by his mercy, because of the life, death, and resurrection of his son, Jesus, here we are in the presence of a holy, righteous, all-powerful God that holds our breath and life in the palm of his hand, where he also holds the planets and the galaxies and the entire universe. He's in heaven, you're on earth. Don't forget who he is. Don't forget who we are. And draw near to listen, meaning, we commit to gather here week after week after week to reorient our lives under the sun around his voice and his words, not our words and our voice. That we gather here week after week to orient our life around his character, not our character. That we gather here week after week to orient our lives around his grace, not our performance. That we gather here week after week to orient our life around his ways, not our ways. I think Solomon would say, it's going to be better in your life if you use your ears more than you use your mouth. And we could all take that in different ways. Just to kind of zoom out here for a second as we come to a close, why do we think this part of chapter 5 comes right after what we just saw in chapter 4? They kind of on their own seem a little disconnected, seem a little unrelated. We just saw this stuff about giving and getting, how we need others, how we need community. Now there's this very kind of weighty thing about approaching the Lord with humility and reverence and a recognition of who we are and who he is. So what's the connection? Well, I would say in no part of this did Solomon really change topics. He just kind of changed angles because the same core topic is there. Both chapter 4 and chapter 5 are both about worship. They're both about worship. The difference between the wise who goes into the door of wisdom and goes to this room and the fool who tries all other doors that lead to the same room is not whether or not you worship, but who you worship and how you worship. Chapter 4 showed us that we can worship ourselves and just be a getter, 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 or we can worship the Lord and be one who gives to others and serves others and needs others and learns from others. Chapter 5 showed us that we can be a person who pridefully divides our worship and divides our hearts, or we can be a person who humbly devotes our worship fully and only to the Lord. It's always been about worship the whole time. And I just want to show you one place that I think brings all of this together in the New Testament. You can turn there with me real quick. It's in Mark chapter 12. The book of Mark, Matthew, Mark, Luke's right after that. So if you get there, you've gone a little too far. Mark chapter 12. I'm going to read verses 28 through 34. So just a small little paragraph in the middle of the chapter. And as we read this, think about how you hear the themes of what we've talked about so far this morning in this passage. And this is where we'll wrap up here. In Mark chapter 12, starting in verse 28. It says, one of the scribes came up and heard them disputing with one another. And seeing that he answered them well, he asked them. So this scribe, this Jewish religious leader, comes up to Jesus and has a question for him. His question is this: which commandment is the most important of all? And here's Jesus' answer in verse 29. Jesus answered, the most important is this: hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. So I'm going to read the rest of it here in just a second, but let's pause there and just take that part in. He comes and asks him the question of which is the greatest commandment, singular. And how many commandments does Jesus give him? Two. He says, hear, O Israel. You could even technically say three. The commandment to hear, and then to love the Lord your God, and then to love your neighbor as yourself. So there's the summary of Jesus. Jesus takes this and says, let me tell you what following me is really like, what all the Old Testament was ultimately about. One, hearing this truth, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. There is only one God. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Draw near to listen. And because there is only one God, you shall love him with all your heart and with all your soul, with all your mind and all your strength. Don't just be about this bunch of rash words and spiritual talk. Actually, love the Lord from the deepest part of your being and follow him in every area of your life. And then he says, you can't separate that from the second commandment. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. It's not about climbing over top of people in life. It's not about getting ahead of other people. Two is better than one. You have to love your neighbor as yourself. You have to live and exist in this world acknowledging the Lord has put people around you to love and to serve. And then here's how this scene wraps up, verse 32. And the scribe said to him, you're right, teacher. You have truly said that he is one and there is no other besides him. And to love him with all the heart, with all the understanding, with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself is much more than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools. And when Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, you are not far from the kingdom of God. Even this scribe gets it. He gets it that Jesus summarizes the way of the wise. He summarizes the way of true meaning in life, that it's full-hearted love for God and a servant-hearted love for people. That the way to meaning in life, the way that is not vanity, the way that is not empty, is devoted, not divided. It's giving, not getting. It's a life of sincere worship of Jesus. Not perfect. None of us perfectly do this, but sincere worship of Jesus and sacrifice for others, that's the door you walk through that leads to satisfaction and meaning in life. And Solomon, we have a little bit left in Ecclesiastes, he's going to keep taking us down that road and making it clear why that's the case. Let's pray together.